Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Katherine Richard, filling in for Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. Now, social media addiction. If you're like me, your smartphone sometimes feels like an appendage. Scrolling social media sites like Facebook and Twitter are often the first thing I do on my phone when I wake up, and often the last thing I do before I hit the sack. So recently, I've been trying to cut back, and the big reason is that I want to model good behavior for my three small children. But the turning point came when my phone started sending me weekly usage updates that showed I was spending what I would say is an unflattering amount of time on social media. And let me tell you this, giving up the scroll has been hard. It's been very hard. And it turns out I'm not alone. There's this growing body of research that suggests that social media is addicting and it's really hard to boot as a result. So today we'll be talking about social media addiction. When does posting pics of your dog or liking wedding pictures turn into a habit that feels impossible to break? And is it possible to use social media moderately? We want you to join the conversation. When did you decide you were addicted to social media? And what are your tricks for cutting back or cutting back altogether? You can connect with us at 651-227-6000 or, yes, you can use Twitter to send me your questions and comments at Kat Richard. Our first guest today is Bailey Parnell. She's a digital marketer based in Toronto who's also challenged herself and others to take time off from social media. Welcome, Bailey.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Our second guest is Sarah Peck from New York. She's the founder and host of the Startup Pregnant podcast, and she has written about social media addiction. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, I want to start with you. What do we know about the science behind social media addiction? What exactly is happening in our brains every time we check Instagram, for instance?
So every time we get on to Twitter or Instagram or any one of these ubiquitous social accounts, we get a dopamine hit. And we get feedback that is a pleasurable response. We get notifications, they light up, and it feels good to check. The problem is we become like those rats that we're pressing pellets and we start to press the lever all day long and we want more and we can't stop.
Now, tell me, what are some of the early signs of social media addiction, Sarah? What did you notice first in yourself?
I think one of the things that becomes so flummoxing is you don't realize how much time you're spending on it. Just like you mentioned earlier, when your iPhone or your other phone tells you exactly how much time you've been spending on social media, you kind of are in shock. Like, what do you mean I spent 12 hours this week checking my Facebook and my Twitter? It doesn't seem reasonable. But then when you're inside of it, you keep scrolling and you think just a little more, or I'll get off just a little bit later. And before you know it, your 8 o'clock bedtime, it's now 11 o'clock and you've got to get up early in the morning and you feel like you've made a big mistake, but you still can't stop. It's really, really hard to get out of it once you're in it.
Right. So Bailey, I listened to a TED Talk that you gave about social media use and mental health. Mm-hmm. And this really resonated with me because I have friends who've stopped using it altogether because it makes them feel inadequate as a professional, as a parent, whatever. And I'm wondering what your experience with this has been.
Absolutely. I mean, the funny thing is that I actually love social media, and I still do, and I say that at the end of the talk. And part of my curiosity in starting my research about social media's impact on mental health was, you know, why was I having a good time here when so many others weren't? And interestingly, when I started doing my research, I thought that I would find a more explicit correlation between time spent on social media and rising levels of anxiety and depression, but that's actually not what I found. I found that there was no consistency in the research, that some people said, yes, there is a correlation. Some people found no correlation at all. And some people even found the opposite, that time on social led to better mental health. So this told me that it wasn't necessarily about the tools themselves, but about who you are offline going into the tools. And I mean, maybe I'm a little bit biased because I own a soft skills training company, but it really is about those soft skills like confidence, self-assurance, mindfulness, like you both are suggesting, being able to, you know, am I mindlessly scrolling for 10 minutes or an hour, or am I actually liking and consuming this thoughtfully? So, I think that I truly believe that it can be used for good or for bad, but we're just in a really particular time of history, which is especially scary for youth right now, where you have youth who are, yes, by every measure addicted, but you don't necessarily have the same supports or guidance from adults and educators who largely grew up without social media. And really what I'm starting to push a lot more now since that talk is that social media is a risky behavior. By every measure in social sciences, we deem a risky behavior something where when you participate, you expose yourself to potential harm. Something like alcohol, drugs, sex, these would all be risky behaviors. And now we know certainly that by participating on social media, you are exposing yourself to potential harm, whether that be, you know, harassment, damning images, whether that be, anxiety, depression, that sort of stuff.
Right. Well, we want you to join our conversation. Did you ditch social media because you felt like it was taking a toll on your mental health? And how did you do it? You can call us at 651-227-6000 or tweet me at Kat Richert. We have a call coming in from Connor in Minneapolis. Go ahead, Connor.
Hey. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm 24 years old. I'm a millennial, and we were kind of basically the first generation to see the evolution of the social media platform. And I got pretty much convinced to do it freshman year of high school, and just I resisted. And honestly, with it kind of being just a real sense of status or showing us value, I think there's also a big sense of social media, not just also letting people know what's going on in your life, but it was a big influence, a tool to making sure to be so involved in other people's lives, to make sure you were socially included and you weren't missing out on anything. And that kind of just put a real stress on myself for a while to make sure I was, knowing what was going on. I felt like I was included,
right?
In
yeah.
the sense that mm-hmm. I wasn't mm-hmm. being isolated. So it's a sense of social anxiety right there.
Right. Connor, you make a really good point that I really want Bailey to follow up on, which mm-hmm. is this idea that, Facebook, for instance, was created so people could connect, even if they weren't in the same place. The idea behind it was that people would feel included, and yet you're expressing that caused a level of anxiety in you. Bailey, can you touch on that for a second?
Yeah, well, absolutely, Connor. I mean, thanks for sharing and calling in, because your experience is extremely common, and more this thing that's supposed to connect us and keep us more connected than ever before is also creating a crisis of loneliness and comparison. And what you're experiencing is kind of a light phrase that we like to call FOMO, or fear of missing out, but not just fear of missing out on what's happening in other people's lives, but now just fear of missing out on what's being posted. And also that idea of being included and letting people know what you're up to, that, if it, that sort of joke phrase right now, that if it's not on Instagram, it didn't happen. And this idea that, there's actually research to support that us talking about ourselves, it lights up the same parts of our brains associated with rewards. So we get, and then on social media, there's research to suggest that we talk about ourselves perhaps about 80% of the time, whereas in real life, it's about 30% of the time. So yes, we are being rewarded, like Sarah said, for talking about ourselves. We have that dopamine going off. We're feeling FOMO for not being on. We're not getting that social currency. And what happens? We are not getting that offline connection that we actually really need. So even though we're more connected, everything still suggests it doesn't replace the offline.
So we have another call coming in from Bob in St. Paul. Bob, what's your question or comment?
I do just Facebook, and only at my personal computer. I don't do much on my phone, which is anathema to me, watching people walk around with their heads buried in their phones. But what bothered me was the Washington Post article in the Washington Post magazine this weekend in the Pioneer Press, going after Mark Zuckerberg and how he has failed to police this juggernaut He has not stood up to the fibs and distortions and all the other bad stuff that goes on. And at one point when he was getting excoriated for it, he hired people to come up with false narratives on the people who were going after him. So not only was he putting a lot of allowing a lot of lies to go on, he was creating lies to go after his critics. And I'm thinking to myself, why should I give any more money to Mark Zuckerberg if this is the way he's going to act? And I think a lot of people are very concerned that he has not learned the lessons of what he has created.
Right.
That's it.
You know, Sarah, I want to throw this question to you. I think Bob raises a good point, which is that we're seeing some people quit or cut back because of their concerns about platforms like Facebook, which has obviously gotten a, you know, bad press recently. What's your take on all of this news around Facebook and how they how users influence the election? And are you seeing people decide to cut back for that reason, Sarah?
This is such a good question. I think it's such a complicated world that we are entering into right now because social media is new, but it's also not going away. Even if Facebook gets taken down, we're still going to have so many companies that are forming some way to connect on the internet that we, my response is that we as individuals need to take responsibility for what we want our relationship for it to look like. So we've got to go into it eyes wide open and say, what do I want? What do I need? And what's not working for me? And so when I did the report for Harvard Business Review, I went through and over 2 years, I did 4 different experiments around my relationship to social media. And just like Bailey was saying, it's not all or nothing. It's not social media is either good or bad. But what you do need to do is figure out what your relationship to it is. Is 45 minutes a day the right thing? Is taking a sabbatical, like you're not going to use social media on Saturdays or the weekends? Are you going to do it only on your laptop, like this caller just said, which I think is a great strategy? Because when I did my experiments, I realized I had very different behavior on my phone versus on my laptop. And I had very different behavior in the morning versus at night. So, and I'm a new parent. I have a 7-week-old. I know you have 3 children, Catherine. It's different when your children are different ages, too. So I recommend that we just go into it and say, look, we're all learning about how these tools work. And some of it's good for us, some of it's neutral, and some of it might be really not so good for us. And what we have to do is take responsibility for the part that we can control and be honest about what we want the tools to do for us.
Great point. We actually have a caller, Ruth in St. Paul. Ruth, what's your question or comment?
Hi. Yeah, my comment first was that I gave up social media in about 2013. And the reason at the time was because I think there was a lot of talk about time wasting. And I was actually really protective of my accounts. I only had maybe 30 friends on, this was only Facebook at the time. And even then I would go down these rabbit holes of, you know, looking at pictures of people I didn't even know and spending a lot of extra time and wasting time. And so now I have, it sounded like you were just talking about children, and I have a 2-year-old. I'm not on social media. I don't know exactly how I'm going to approach this with him as he grows up.
Well, Sarah, Bailey, go ahead. I think Ruth raises a great point, and I've sort of struggled with this myself. How do I model that good behavior for my kids? I don't think social media is all bad, but I also don't want my children to think that it's the number one thing that I want to do even when they're in the same room with me.
Well, I just have to say that I just love that both of you are all 3 of you are talking about modeling good behavior because ever since that TED Talk, what I've largely gone towards is how do we practice safe social? How do we make this exactly what you're asking, a space where we can show youth, especially right now, how to do this well? And I want to bring up what I said about social media being a risky behavior like sex, drugs, or alcohol, because when you think of it that way, the treatment is actually fairly similar. So we start with things like making sure we're speaking the same language and awareness. And I mean this on parents as well. This is where parents and educators need to start doing the work right now. Do you even understand what a Snapchat streak is? Do you know what an Instagram DM is? And do you really, really, truly understand why that teenager feels really like they need to check it this moment, because it actually makes perfect sense for their cognitive development. And then just like sex, drugs, and alcohol, you have the talk, you moderate behavior, you make sure that there's dedicated offline time, you make sure you make your kid put down their phone. You make them, whether it's the dinner table for you or wherever you decide. And I actually do feel empathy for parents now, because, you know, you're working harder than ever before. Certainly most of my friends have more than one job, and you get home and it is just easier to give that kid the tablet than to listen to them cry or to put them in front of the TV. But what everything is suggesting is that it's not helping them, even for social. And so you have the talk, just like sex or drugs, and you moderate behavior. You make sure that what you're consuming is something you actually like. You're not just doing it because you feel forced to. You're not peer pressured into it. You're not, you know, you don't dislike it, but it's normal. So I have to be on here. Nobody makes fun of you for abstaining. And then you build those offline soft skills, sort of like this might sound very similar to something like alcoholism. You build skills like self-awareness, like Sarah was suggesting. What do you know what actually stresses you out? And do you know when that's put in flux, your beliefs, your values? Are you building confidence? Are you building resilience so that when things do happen, you can bounce back? And then modeling good behavior, it sounds like the fact that you're even, all three of you are even thinking about it, puts you a step ahead, because it's going to be very hard for millennials, especially, to parent kids and to say, get off your phone, when they themselves have been documenting those kids' whole lives since they were born.
So I want everyone to join our conversation. I want to know how you're talking to your kids about social media. You can call us at 651-227-6000 or tweet me at Kat Richard. And speaking of Twitter, we have a few people calling out on Twitter how they have curbed their own social media use. Kimberly says, I keep social media on my phone and recently bought a tablet specifically so I can keep social media off of it. And I already feel the return of my IQ. Kelly says, deleting the Facebook app off of my phone was a big help. Also, an app that monitored my activity on my phone and told me just how much time I was wasting through Twitter and Instagram. Now I set a limit for myself each day. So, Sarah, you mentioned this Harvard Business Review story you did a while back, which I really enjoyed reading. I loved how you sort of laid out all of these experiments you did on your own social media usage. I want to know, what did you learn about yourself in that process? Tell me more about what you found in terms of what your triggers were, when you used it most, how you were using it.
Yeah, this was so fascinating, because I think one of the best things you can get out of running experiments is knowledge and data about who you are as a person. And so I set up these four different experiments. One of them, I went off of all social media for an entire month. That was 2 years ago. I haven't done it since, but I took a sabbatical for a month. And what happened was I still grabbed my phone and I wanted something to do. There was still the impulse. But instead of reading all of Facebook, I ended up reading like 8 books. And I realized that I was much happier with that as an outcome. I did another experiment where I blocked social media just in the morning until 11 a.m. So when I got up in the morning, I wasn't checking right away. And that one was really helpful for me. I found that if I did the biggest, hardest piece of work that I had to do first, oh, my day was so much better, and I had more attention and more ability to focus. I found the hardest time for me is around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm super tired. I've been awake far too long. Work has gotten me down. I've probably gotten some emails I didn't want to get. And so by 4 o'clock, I'm just craving anything easy or simple or mindless or just numbing out a little bit. So I call it that happy hour from 4 to 5 p.m. where you're just looking for, like Bailey says, that's when you want your glass of wine or mm-hmm. you want something easy. And so that was my danger zone, was both the late afternoon and again after I put my kids to bed around 8 o'clock at night. Oh, it's so tempting. I could spend another 4 hours at night just watching something on Hulu or on Netflix. And so I ended up setting up these blockers so that all of social media and all of the television shows automatically get redirected on my website. I use a tool called Freedom. And if I'm still watching something or reading something at 9 o'clock at night, it automatically shuts off. And so I've now learned that I have to start my television show by 8:30 p.m. Otherwise, I won't be able to finish it. And I've trained myself, if it's 8:40 or 8:45 p.m., I'm like, oh, darn, I don't have enough time to watch TV. I guess we'll have to watch this tomorrow, which has been so wonderful for me personally. And the last experiment I did, number four, was it's called a 24-hour reset, and it's inspired by religion, by the Sabbath, by the idea of taking a rest day. And Tiffany Schlain actually came up with this, and I modeled after her. So you just take a full day off on Saturday or Sunday. You just put your phone in a drawer, close your laptop, and do not get onto your devices. The best way to do this is to actually have something better to do, like go to the zoo. Or, you know, if it's winter, go out and go ice skating or go on a long hike and leave your devices behind or switch them into airplane mode.
Yeah.
It, for me, is a really powerful way to reset.
Sarah, I just want to say that I really identified with your observation in the article about using it when you're tired, because I am totally in the same boat. My brain is mush at the end of the day, and I find it to just be weirdly very soothing to scroll through, you know, Instagram, Twitter, whatever it might be. Why do you think there's something about the tired mind that makes you especially vulnerable to the desire to use social media?
We want something easy, and we want to feel better. And I'll tell you a slightly related thing that worked really well for me. Being pregnant for most of the last year, I was so extremely tired at the end of the day. Parents out there can relate. I would eat a ton of sugar at the end of the day. I live in New York City on top of a Dunkin' Donuts. So I would just walk downstairs and get like 10 donuts. Not good for me, but it was so easy. And I told my husband, I just want to feel better. And we realized that if he gave me a 5-minute foot rub, I didn't have a sugar craving anymore. And so every night, if he saw me eating sugar, he would come over and rub my feet. And I tell that story because I actually think we're looking for something that feels good. We're looking for something that's pleasurable, and we're looking for something that's easy. And instead of trying to use willpower, which doesn't work, instead of trying to force yourself not to do something, instead try giving yourself something really nice. Like maybe you take a bath, or you go get a pedicure, or you know that you feel better after lifting weights. So you have some 25 pounders at home and you do a couple of weights. This is my husband. When he comes home from work, he's so stressed out. He asked if he could just take a shower. He's like, can I just go straight for the shower and avoid the kids, have 10 minutes? And I said, sure, you can have that. And these are the little coping strategies that help when you're that tired.
Bailey, I want you to weigh in. I feel like you have something to say.
Oh, definitely. I think everything Sarah tried, it should actually sound quite similar again to the treatment for something like alcoholism. When you know you're addicted, this is what I like to call digital well-being strategies and that we're talking about. And like she suggested, she tried a detox. If you're addicted to alcohol, you actually need to get it out of your system. She tried different types of usage, maybe taking it out of the house. This is stuff you do. She tried distracting yourself. Sometimes it's just not enough. Willpower is just not enough for an alcoholic. You actually need to get it out of the house. You need to do something else. And really, it really is the same, because regarding social media, we are having the same results in our brains as substance dependencies, and the treatment is actually quite similar. And I think Sarah spoke to that perfectly.
Yeah. So we have David in Duluth. David, go ahead. What's your question or your comment?
I'm sorry. I'm chewing an orange. Okay. I just want to talk
a good
about,
social media distraction social media? There. Go ahead.
I left social media for the most part. I still have an account that I check every once in a while. But it's not about like fear of missing out. Like I actually am missing out on things. Like there'll be a party that I hear about that I wasn't invited to, and then I'll check my Facebook and it turns out I was invited. I just didn't know because I wasn't checking my Facebook. And I guess I want to talk about kind of like from a societal perspective, like what we could do to kind of create norms that kind of account for the fact that some people aren't on social media and still include them. Because I don't feel like people are excluding me deliberately. It's just that I'm not using the the format that people use to invite people to things anymore.
Yeah, David, I love your comment because I think it gets at sort of the light and dark side of social media. I mean, I know that I love staying in touch with people who maybe I haven't seen in years who live far away. But, you know, I know what their kid looked like on the first day of kindergarten or what their wedding pictures look like. I enjoy that. But at the same time, if you're not tapping into that, you can feel left out. Bailey, can you speak to that a little bit? How do you find that happy medium there?
Sure. And, you know, thank you for sharing that perspective because it really has woven itself into every part of our culture. And one of the things that I talk to people about now is that even if you are choosing to abstain yourself, social media will still be a part of your life. Even right now, we're talking about it on the radio. If you're not on social media, you might not understand what we're talking about or you're going to hear it anyways. And, you know, again, this sounds like drinking. I know I keep bringing that up, but when someone doesn't drink, you know, you hear these things like, what? You don't drink? What? Or, you know, team socials, companies go out for a social and it's at a bar, or you have a wedding and are you serving a mocktail as well? And I know it sounds wild, but when we're thinking about social media, we need to get to that layer still where we're thinking, as you suggested, that, you know, I'm inviting people via social. Wait a sec. Do I have any friends who are not on social? Or I'm not just invitations, but let's see, or like for students, for example, they have a lot of their groups online. So one thing I suggest to my students is, okay, when you get together in a student group, go around the group and say, what's the best way for everyone to be communicated with? Because we can't assume everyone's going to be on WhatsApp. And so the other option is, so we can't make, I guess tying that up is we can't make people feel weird for abstaining, but we also need that second layer of understanding and of a critical lens in people to be able to ask those questions. And one thing I'm a little bit, I guess, apprehensive about right now for you is that I'm not sure we're at the phase yet where everyone understands what social media is doing to them. And then I think only then can you get to the phase of, okay, well, how do we treat people who are deciding to abstain? How do we get past that stigma? So it's difficult because we are in that phase of history right now. We are writing the history books with how we treat social media. And so just hold out because we will get there.
So on that note, let's talk about some of the positive sides of social media. We have Brant in Bemidji who has some observations on this. Brant, go ahead.
Yeah, I was talking earlier with a fellow just about my interaction on social media, and I made a big observation that most of what I see is negative. It's just a negative aspect of some news story or a negative comment about some political figure or something like that. So where I didn't decide to abstain from social media, I made the decision to just post things that are positive, that are encouraging, that are going to lift people up, that are going to help them through their daily life. And as I've seen this play out over the last year or so, I've gotten a lot of good feedback and people are saying, well, thank you for that comment or thank you for that positive post or that post from scripture or something, you know, that's just really trying to uplift people rather than build negativity into our social lives. And I think that's such a great thing because, I mean, if we're not trying to lift people up, then we're trying to tear them down or cause them to think negatively about something.
Great point, Brant. Thanks for calling in. I want you to join the conversation. I want to hear how you've curbed your own social media use, and I want to hear your tips or clever ways that you are cutting back. What sort of software are you using? Or are you just ditching the phone altogether, as I recently did on a vacation and found it to be very freeing and wonderful in lots of ways? Sarah, I want to go back to that article that you wrote for the Harvard Business Review. It also talked about some of the tools that we can use to cut back on social media use. Tell me a little bit more about what you have found works for you.
Yeah, I think what Brant just said was so interesting about how some of it can be negative and some of it can be positive. And something that could really help is thinking about there's the social aspect and there's the media aspect. And media is, it has a long history of being designed to be inflammatory and trigger you and to get you to click. We see those articles, the number one way to fat loss or seven ways that such and such did so-and-so. And we click on it. Well, one of the ways that I found to really pull back on social media and get back into the positive space is to focus on the social aspect and to create really small groups. Sometimes we just have too many inputs, and it becomes this danger zone, this risky zone, like Bailey was suggesting. So when I create a group, I'll go on something like Marco Polo or Voxer. I don't know if people know of these tools, but they're a video-to-video messaging and walkie-talkie app. And I create a small group of six friends, and we get to talk to each other, and there isn't any of that media part. I'm not sending an update to my friend saying, here's seven things I did today, and they're spectacular. Instead, I get to just say, hey, I'm super tired. You know, my kid woke me up at 4 a.m., and I've had two coffees. And I get to stay in touch with my friend instead. So some of the tools you can use to help yourself stay accountable. I love the iPhone has a screen time measurement now, if you've updated to the latest version. You can use Freedom both on your phone and on your device. And I really like the program called Rescue Time, which just tracks everything you do on your laptop and gives you a report at the end of every day.
Yeah, you know, on Twitter, NPR's Nina Moyney, she's our fellow reporter here, says that as I'm scrolling through social media, there are several apps that track your usage and even some that block you after a while. It can be a real wake-up call to actually see the amount of time that's spent. She says it's concerning for her, too, because of distracted driving with so many people being killed in traffic. And that leads me to a call coming in from Victor in Rochester. Victor, what are your observations about your kids' usage of social media and computers generally for schoolwork?
Big question. In fact, I think that social media is doing a lot of good things, but more bad things to our kids and ourselves. For instance, when you talk about kids getting together at a school program, a school platform, contributing to each other and helping each other, sometimes homework and stuff like that, it's a good thing. But when it comes to social media about communicating, talking to friends and bullying people on social media, it bothers me a lot. And I think about it every day asking myself, what can we do about these things? One basic thing that bothers me a lot is, for instance, you and your wife go, you say, oh, tonight let's go out for dinner. You get to a dinner, husband pull up a phone, wife pull up a phone, and you see these two people who are supposed to be there and talking about some important thing, both of them are on the phone. And it seems to be like the social media has taken captive of our brain.
Right.
And if you are not on there at a certain time, you are left out.
Yeah, you know, Victor, I think that's a really good point. But I also want to get back to what you said earlier about academics and using tablets, social media, that sort of thing. Sarah, I'm wondering if any of the tools that you just talked about allow parents to monitor their kids' usage, even though that seems to be where, you know, academics are going in terms of using tablets, using social media to do schoolwork. How do you find that happy medium there for your kids?
That's such an interesting question, and it's so complicated because on the one hand, I have a lot of hope and inspiration coming from the generations behind us. There are generations that are younger than us that are saying, actually, social media seems scary and dangerous, and they're abstaining in a way that maybe the parents' generation right now, we're the adolescents, and we are more addicted. But it's also so tricky. How do you monitor somebody else's usage, and how do you teach them to use it wisely? That to me is, it's kind of the crux of parenting, right? How are we going to teach our teenagers how to understand what alcohol is and not use it, or understand what sex is and when to do it and when not to do it, and how to wait and what that looks like? These are the hardest conversations to have. And it requires us to model really good behavior and to communicate really well with our children and to be there for them and to create structures of support. I know that there are a lot of parental restrictions that you can put on. You can go in, you can block different websites, but I also know that kids are really, really smart. I mean, when I was a teenager, I got around my parents' rules. I knew how to do it. I knew how to figure it out. So we can't rely just on technology to solve technology. We also have to be human.
And Bailey, before we wrap up here, I just want to hear from you. Any final sort of practical tips that you would throw out there for parents who are interested in helping their kids, you know, cut back?
Yeah, that's just amazing. Really bringing it back to that offline soft skills. I can't stress that enough. If the kid is going to drink, he's going to find a way to get a drink. And just the same with social media, I see these teenagers who give their, you know, this is where parents need to really understand the language, because they might ground their kid from the phone, but then they just go on desktop and go on Instagram, or they go on their friend's phone. So there are parent control apps that you can use, like there's ones called, you know, Safe Kids or Norton Family or Net Nanny or Family Time Premium, these sort of parent control apps. But really making sure that those offline soft skills are built, like discussions with your kids about what happens when they are bullied. Those used to be offline, but do they feel safe coming to you? Because, you know, abstinence training isn't really an option here. Because, again, even if you abstain, it's part of your life. And so parents need to learn the language, need to model good behavior, make sure that you also have your phones down, and really need to practice that self-control.
Thank you so much to our guest. Bailey Parnell joined us from Toronto. She's a digital marketing expert. Thank you, Bailey.
And thank you for having me.
And we had Sarah Peck joining us from New York. She's the founder and host of the Startup Pregnant podcast. She's written about social media addiction. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.